Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge. Was it the Cape Drive Time? Welcome back to the show. 072-238-0712 is the WhatsApp line. And somebody asking the question here, they went to Westgate Mall and this shop charged them 32 Rand for a surgical mask. Now, I want to ask the question, is 32 Rand the going price for a surgical mask? Because I haven't got a cooking clue. So WhatsApp us, 072-238-0712. Is 32 Rand the going price for a surgical mask? And surely, if you're a pensioner, you could be given something of a deal. WhatsApp us, and if that is an excessive price, we'll expose the particular shop at the Westgate Mall for profiteering. But first of all, we need to know, is 32 bucks a pop? Is 32 Rand a fair price for a surgical mask? Let's go to our weekly focus on the Middle East Eye. I don't know where the logo has gone to. It seems to have disappeared in the system. In our weekly focus on Middle East with the London-based online news source Middle East Eye, David Hurst, our regular correspondent and editor-in-chief, is taking a break for a few weeks. And our contributor this week is Azad Essa, who is the Middle East Eye's senior reporter based in New York. Azad is well known to us in South Africa. He hails from the Republic of KwaZulu-Natal and has appeared on VOC a number of times. He's also an author, The Muslims Are Coming and Zuma's Bastards. We start off with Kashmir, which under the new legislation offers people who have resided in the region for 50 years the opportunity to purchase land and to become a permanent resident. To me, that smacks of political gerrymandering by Modi, but we'll hear about that later. Also, Israel and India have struck an arms deal during the midst of the coronavirus. What's the morality of that? And your Pulitzer Prize-winning author and diplomat Samantha Power shows her petticoat, some weak points. And Iran, one of the countries worst affected by COVID-19, is desperately calling for the lifting of U.S. sanctions, particularly on medicines. Azad Essa, senior reporter for the Middle East Eye, joins us online from New York. And of course, you can get them at www.middleeasteye.net, Twitter handle at Middle East Eye. Azad Essa, assalamu alaikum.
Welcome, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much indeed. Let's sort of kick off with this is something that will certainly get a lot of people hot under the collar. The India going on, steaming on ahead with its oppression and repression of Kashmir. And this law, 15 years, we've been a resident for 15 years, you can purchase land and become a permanent resident, is taken from the Zionist copybook, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just to get your listeners up to speed, a few days ago, the Ministry of Home Affairs issued a gazette for this new law. It would mean that essentially it would change what it means to be a resident of Kashmir. And I think that's the key part. You know, people hear about this word domicile, but not everyone understands what that means, right? And this order repeals a number of existing laws in the state. And more significantly, it changes what it means, you know, in terms of determining who is a resident. And effectively, as you say, you know, pulling out from the Israeli playbook, it effectively puts into motion the settler colonial ambitions of the Indian government. Now, the laws now define anyone who has lived in Kashmir for 15 years or more, and has or has studied for 7 years and has appeared in, like, you know, matric, for example, to be suddenly a resident of the state. Now, this means that it also will include Indian officials, whether they are from the bureaucracy, or whether they are like lecturers, or whether they are in the army, to suddenly now become residents of that place. I mean, it's really unreal. So it's even migrants who have come in from other parts of the country to work in the service sector, such as now suddenly they are all residents. Now, you immediately brought up the question of the Israeli playbook, and in many ways this is directly from the Israeli playbook, in that the attempt here is to try and change the demography of the region, and that means to change the reality on the ground by bringing in Indians and specifically Hindus to the region. So in a way, it's like trying to replicate the Israeli settlements idea, where we have a situation where the Israeli government today presents settlements as a kind of proof that they belong there, you know? And so once you change the demography, then you dilute the region's ambitions, you know, and the region's identity. And so this idea of it being, it looking for or wanting self-determination or freedom, etc., that all goes out the window.
Yeah, and of course, India at the moment is getting away with it because everybody right now is focused on COVID-19. So it's a convenient time, as you said so correctly, to create new facts on the ground. And then when we wake up, it's all done and dusted.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is exactly what Kashmiris have been fearing, you know, since this Article 317 was abrogated in August. And that article had previously given, you know, Jammu and Kashmir a special status in the Indian constitution, you know, which meant that it had its rights, its own constitution, had its own right to determine its own residency laws. And now India has made it its own, it made the region into a union territory directly under the control of the central government. So now the world's most militarized area has become even more militarized. And if you consider that, what they did was that they put the region under communication blackout and a communication blockade as such, you know, for months. And that still continues, in that the internet is still very slow in Kashmir. It's like 2G, which means that, you know, to put into the current context of what India is facing, what the world is facing, what you and I are facing, wherever we are, doctors aren't able to even download the latest training material from the internet, you know, to understand how they're supposed to be treating patients, how they're supposed to be, you know, conducting the best practices, because the internet is so slow. Now, if you consider the people who are under lockdown or who have been asked to stay at home in Kashmir, think about the children in South Africa or elsewhere who are using online resources. Now, these kids in Kashmir aren't able to even, you know, do the simple things, whether it is streaming video or whether it is, you know, downloading online material to continue the education. But this has been going on for so many months, and it continues. So even in the midst of this corona outbreak and this pandemic, this type of cruelty is just, you know, just emboldened in a way.
No, most certainly. And, of course, what we have to factor into this, and this is obviously never going to reach the headlines or even get into mainstream media at the moment, is that I'm pretty damn sure that the people of Kashmir are not going to take this lying down, that the Indian moves are going to be met with resistance. So it's just going to ratchet up the tension in Kashmir, at the border, and in the whole region.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to understand what Kashmiris would be thinking right now, because you know, every week, every month, something else has been taken away from them. And so the level of desperation and the level of outrage is, you know, reaching, you know, unprecedented levels. But at the same time, the place is so heavily militarized. And if you think about what has been happening in India with this Anti-Citizenship Amendment Act, protests, you think about the brutality that Indian Muslims have faced in Delhi, in the capital, at the universities. You know, consider what it might be in a place like Kashmir, where, you know, the military is actually taking charge of all of these things, and there's no media, there's no spotlight, there's no proper internet. So, yes, there's major outrage and major hurt at what has taken place now, but there's also, it's not clear what Kashmiris can do at this point, because so many of the, you know, so many of the platforms, etc., have been dismantled, you know, And with this coronavirus as well, getting sick in Kashmir is also akin to, a death sentence at this point, because there's so few proper medical supplies and equipment and space, to recover. So the thing is that, yes, tensions are going to be very high, but, it's not clear what's going to happen next.
No, absolutely. I think the one certainty that's come out of it is that India, under Narendra Modi, has elevated its status to a pariah state.
I think we are far past whether this is an authoritarian regime or a pariah state. I think it's very clear that India, Israel, Saudi Arabia, these are all countries that are part of the same clique now, completely. And so I think that's beyond doubt.
No, absolutely. And of course, anger building up, perhaps not only in Kashmir, but around the world, in that most intelligent people are looking at this and going, hang on a minute, this is not right. It's one just hopes at the end of the day that the world actually wakes up and actually says and does something about the injustices rather than just thinking about it, which I think is the case right now.
Yeah, I think what this also has shown is the utter, uselessness, if that's the word, to put it in a mild way, of the United Nations, for instance. The UN has absolutely no, they don't have a buck left at this point. And so I think that much of what's going on today is a failure of the international system. And it's also a failure of many, many governments who have just bought into this idea of self-interest. No one's really going to speak up about what's happening in India because, there's too many things at stake, economically. And this coronavirus, is meant to illustrate to us that we don't really have control of, most things and the important things, right? And this sort of like capital and corporate, focused and obsessed economy is not going to get us anywhere. It's destroying our environment. It's destroying our health. It doesn't protect us, But I don't think these lessons are going to be learned. So to think that, that India would go ahead at this point, when they are completely failing to even look after their own people in mainland India when it comes to this coronavirus, to go ahead in Kashmir and now start changing the laws there and start changing things there. It's really an indictment on the inability of the rest of the world to actually do anything about it.
No, absolutely. And of course, that leads on to the fact that Israel and India are very cozy, in an arms deal. Which right now takes obscenity to a new level. I mean, who needs arms right now? People need syringes and medical gear right now.
Yeah, I mean, the story is from the end of last week, and it's still relevant, because the Indian government essentially went ahead with buying 16,500 light machine guns from an Israeli weapons manufacturer, and it cost $116 million. And they don't have masks in the hospitals. They in some places people are using to protect themselves, and they're buying groceries. They're using banana leaves. I mean, it's really it takes ludicrous to another front. And India right now is not, the epicenter of this pandemic, but it really could become that. One epidemiologist said that 55% of the country, and that means around 750 million Indians could have the virus. And if things are not taken seriously, there could be 30,000 deaths by May. This is very serious stuff, And so to think that, this military deal was arranged, is greenlit in 2018. But all kinds of military deals, before they're signed off, it always takes into consideration, the current context. That's how it works. There are many deals, are cancelled at the last second because of an economic issue or a prioritization of funds, some other parts of the economy. And to think that this is, in the middle of this pandemic, they go ahead with it. It just hones in the point that this is not a very caring government. Now, after this military deal took place, the Indian government also went ahead with now, shutting down the country, asking people to stay home. And before they did that, they cancelled the railroads, they cancelled the train networks and the bus networks. Now, in India, you have millions, like hundreds of millions, who are working in urban areas that are day labor, day laborers and hourly workers. And if they don't have a job in the city, they don't have any business being in the city. So they got to get home. They got to go back to the farm. They got to go back to their villages because they can't afford to stay in the city. And living in the city means that, they're living in 20 in a room, those kinds of conditions. So after canceling the train networks and the bus networks, et cetera, they then decide that everyone should stay indoors and stay at home. And suddenly it set off hundreds of, millions, to put it mildly, to on a trek back home. People are trying to walk home 200 kilometers.
I've seen the footage. I've seen the footage. It's heartrending. I mean, people walking on the side of the road with babies.
It's completely bizarre. And so the Indian media, for some reason, have not picked on this story, this military deal. And in some ways, you can understand that they are dealing with a lot of things. On the other hand, the Indian media, the majority of which are extremely partial to government narrative, right? And so the relations between Israel have become so normalized. The militarization of Indian society has become so normalized that they just think this is a normal thing to do, that even if we are having a pandemic, that, deals like this need to go on. But you've got to ask yourself, really, is it business as normal? And ordinarily, this shouldn't be business as normal, right? But to be doing it during the pandemic and to not cover it and to not think that it's an issue, and therefore not to cancel it, shows that India is 100% a fascist regime now. And the society is also reproducing those ideas.
Those values, most certainly. We're going to cross over for the 5:30 news bulletin. Azad, stay online. We're talking to Azad Esser, senior reporter at the Middle East Eye. You get him www.middleeasteye.net, Twitter handle @MiddleEastEye. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about Samantha Power, Iran, and don't go away.
In your news making headlines, the MEC for Community Safety urges the public to report police who abuse their power during lockdown. Only 5 of the fleet of 60 mobile testing units are ready to begin going into communities. 2 men who were arrested for the rape and murder of an elderly KwaZulu-Natal woman while posing as SANDF soldiers earlier this week. And a tally reveals that half the global population is currently under lockdown. Those are your headlines. Catch the details at the top of the hour.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Middle East Report on Drive Time with Middle East Eye.
Now, there we have it. And, of course, www.middleeastei.net, Twitter handle at Middle East Eye. And joining us this week, Azad Essa, senior reporter for the Middle East Eye. But, of course, he's a South African born and bred journalist currently working out of New York. Azad, let's have a look now at Samantha Power, youngest ever U.S. ambassador to the U.N., part of the Obama administration, writes a book. But what is interesting about the book is not what she says, but actually what she doesn't say.
So it might seem a little bit strange to be talking about Samantha Power at a time like this, but you know, I had to write this essay about her memoir that came out late last year. And I think it's a really important read because it really gives, you know, the rest of us an idea of this American imperial, you know, machine, you know, and her experience is very illuminating in this regard, you know. So her book is called An Education of an Idealist, and it talks about her growing up in Ireland and then becoming a journalist, an award-winning journalist, and a professor at Harvard, and then joining the Obama administration. And so the book looks at her experiences and what it was like to work with Obama and why she joined the administration. So she says that she became tired of working as a foreign policy critic and wanted to try and see if she could pass the moral sort of tests, you know, that she expected others, you know, to pass, you know, in administrations. Now, the crucial part is that her first book, you know, A Problem from Hell, was about how the U.S. during the 20th century had failed to intervene in major sort of catastrophes, human atrocities, and genocide, etc., like Rwanda. And basically looks at the reasons why the U.S. were not able to do anything, and kind of like is very damning of U.S. foreign policy in that way. So now she joins the Obama administration, and ultimately in 2013 becomes his ambassador to the United Nations. So effectively, you know, I'm sorry for the whole introduction, but effectively becoming the diplomat, you know, the diplomat, you know, for the U.S. For the U.S. government. So basically, she becomes the United States, you know, in terms of diplomacy, in terms of pushing for human rights, pushing for interventions, pushing for all kinds of things. So she becomes that person. And this book then basically writes about all the things that happened behind the scenes. Now, to your question about the things that she leaves out, you know, like many other people who had worked within the Obama administration, Samantha Power becomes another person that kind of like whitewashes Obama's legacy. So, you know, so for instance, she talks about like Obama having gotten rid or addressed this issue of torture, right? And so she holds it out as something that's really like a big deal, like, you know, Obama ended torture. But she makes no, you know, as I write in the piece, she makes no reference to this, to the administration's preferred method of war under Obama, and that was drone strikes. You know, Obama had ordered by the end of his by the end of his presidency, had ordered like 542 drone strikes that killed almost 4,000 people, including 300 civilians. She doesn't even mention that. She credits Obama for banning violators of human rights from entering the United States. And at the same time, Obama is the person that allowed Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi back into the country, into the U.S. You know, he was banned from the U.S. after he was the chief minister of Gujarat when there were these riots and anti-Muslim pogroms in 2002. So he had been banned from the country because of his role in those riots. And like that, there's a bunch of other things that Samantha Power just, you know, just leaves out. And I'll give you two more examples. One is that it's very important because she was a journalist. And when Obama was running for president, you know, he promised that his administration, you know, this was coming out of the George Bush administration, you know, Iraq war and all of these things, the lies that created these ridiculous situations in the Middle East. Obama promised that his administration would be the most transparent. You know, in the end, it actually became one of the most secretive administrations. And it also, he oversaw an unprecedented crackdown on journalists on issues of national security. So you think about Snowden and think about all those matters. You know, this all happened under Obama, and people forget that. And interestingly, she, you know, with regards to this coronavirus, you know, in her book, she talks about Obama's leadership when it came to the Ebola crisis, which is it's true that the Obama administration did help West Africa in sorting that Ebola crisis in 2014, 2016. But what she doesn't say is that it was only after an American was diagnosed with Ebola, like 6 or 7 months after the first set of Ebola cases came about or were reported, that the U.S. actually started taking it seriously because they were worried that it was going to go to the U.S. So the entire sentiment that I get from this book is this overarching theme of like American exceptionalism, you know, where she is extremely, you know, putting all her bets, you know, hedging all her bets rather. On the idea that American exceptionism, you know, American morality will come through ultimately. And it doesn't come through. I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah, certainly. Let's get into the issue of Iran. It's absolutely tragic that Iranian doctors are really struggling. And they're struggling not because they're bad doctors. They're struggling because nobody on the face of this earth has got the guts to allow Iran to have the normal medical facilities that any normal country has a right to.
Yeah, so this is in some ways a complicated issue and yet not that complicated, you know, ultimately. Humanitarian and medical supplies are exempt, you know, from the overall sanctions, you know, but as you say, because the U.S. government have imposed such harsh sanctions on Iran, there's this concept called secondary sanctions, which means that if you trade with Iran, then you can have sanctions imposed on you. And if you are like a financial, you know, a provider, you know, a bank, etc., if you are the person that organizes this trade deal, you could also have sanctions imposed on you. So as you say, nobody wants to help or to facilitate, you know, trade. So just to be clear, the humanitarian goods are not banned, but it's close to impossible to get goods because no one wants to trade, which is ultimately the same thing. And this coronavirus is just like a perfect storm. It's not that this didn't exist already. You know, sanctions have been going on for a long time, and then it was under Obama's administration, it was lifted, and yet under Trump, it came back, and you know, cancer patients have been battling with not getting the right medication. Those suffering from epilepsy are not able to get the right medication. So this has been going on for a while. Now, as I said, the coronavirus just, you know, takes it to another place altogether. Now, a number of countries recently have been asking the U.S. These include China, these include Russia, the entire European Union, United Nations Secretary General. And even members of the U.S. Congress, you know, lawmakers, have called for sanctions to be lifted, but the U.S. has refused to budge. In many ways, you could say that the U.S. has actually doubled down on its stance, you know, accusing the Iranian government of trying to use the pandemic for political mileage, accusing the government of lying, you know, the whole range of things. Now, the U.S. did offer medical help, but Iran turned this down. But pressure is building for the sanctions to be lifted. But, Shafiq, I don't think it's, you know, high up on Trump's list of priorities. And then the cases in Iran keep on going up. There have been more than 50,000 now, 2,000 fatalities. So instead of Trump looking at the U.S. and seeing how a country like the U.S., which is meant to be the richest country in the world, where you have, you know, where it's unclear for many people how to get a test still, you know, where it's unclear that if you actually, you know, get a test and you are positive with coronavirus and you are sick, that you will get a bed. And if you get a bed, will you actually get a ventilator? And if you get a bed, will you get a doctor that actually has the equipment to help you? Now, considering all of those things that are happening in the U.S., for the U.S. government not to actually think a little bit ahead and look a bit to the east and look at Iran and think like, hey, you know what? Maybe we need to just calm down a bit here because we're gonna really cause a massive catastrophe in that country. It's just, you know, they're totally blindsided.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Azad, we're going to have to leave it there. Azad Esser, Middle East Eye senior reporter. Of course, you can get them at www.middleeasteye.net, a Twitter handle at Middle East Eye, and Azad will be back with us same time next week. Azad, shukran for chatting to us.
No, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Report on Drive Time with Middle East Eye.
My radio station, your radio station, our radio station, the voice of the Cape.
Yeah, at AHK Motor Spares, we ride on.